John Stossel.
So how'd we do this year? We have an all-star libertarian panel to examine that. Cato Institute Vice President David Bowes, Harvard Economics Professor Jeffrey Miron, Reason Magazine's Catherine Mangu Ward, and America's Future Foundation VP Camille Foster. So start with the economy. Are we more free, less free? Good news?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. We're at least talking about the issue in a slightly different way. It's no longer toxic to talk about spending or reforming entitlements. We all understand at this point that it's something that needs to happen.
Unfortunately, it's toxic, just talk. And that changed this. It may still be a little toxic, and a lot of them are reluctant, but that did change. Yeah. That's good. Catherine?
Maybe the talking is changing, but so far, the reality is still we're overspending massively. There's no sign that that's going to change. Republicans are going to get into power, and I fear act an awful lot like their Democratic counterparts.
What do you mean, no sign? They're talking about responsibility?
Well, I think we all know that when politicians talk about something, it's entirely different than when they actually act.
But hasn't the narrative changed this year? You're not more hopeful?
I think I am more hopeful only insofar as we're maybe getting close to hitting bottom.
Jeffrey?
I guess I have to agree with most of that. I don't think the prospect that we might get a Republican administration or a more Republican Congress should make us all that confident we're going to get more liberty or have better economic policy or anything else. Republicans were pretty close to a disaster under 8 years of George Bush. And true, things in many ways got even worse in the last 3 years. But lots of the things that the politicians for the Republicans, the presidential candidates are saying, should make us just as worried as anything we're experiencing now.
David Bowes?
It's possible that if the Republicans had been in power the last couple of years, they wouldn't have spent as much money as the Democrats, although looking at the Bush years, you can't be sure of that. But once the Democrats ratchet spending up to this level, you're not seeing Republicans talking about actually reducing spending. They talk about reducing the growth of spending and we've got to get spending under control. But spending has doubled. Annual federal spending has doubled in 10 years. And nobody's saying, are we getting more for our money than we did 10 years ago?
We have this chart that shows how under every administration, it's always gone up. And it goes up even more sharply, more recently under Bush and Obama. But at least that's provoked talks of cuts.
There was the
deficit compromise, the super committee.
It has provoked talk of cuts. But so far, talk is really all it is. And I have to say, John, one of the depressing things going on here is the Democrats have started talking about tax increases. They seem to think that they can get away with that. And they are so desperate to raise taxes, they can taste it. You can see it in their faces. They want to raise taxes. And apparently, they're no longer afraid to say so. They think if you talk only about raising taxes on the rich, we're down to 1%. How can the 99% be against raising taxes on the rich? And this is part of what big government does. It tries to pick out groups and let's target things on them. Nobody wants to target spending cuts on anybody, but they talk about how they can raise taxes on the rich, and they think they can win elections that way. We're going to find out.
Well, yes, and the super committee failed, partly because of that issue. The Republicans said no to the tax increases. And I was struck by the hysteria after the failure, because even from Republicans, oh, we failed, we're going to have to make draconian cuts in military spending. But look at this chart that shows what the automatic cuts will be from the debt compromise.
This whole dramatic desperation that they're going to cut spending, the debt compromise, it's barely noticeable. And the spending keeps on rising.
Yeah, it's not a real cut. It's just a cut in the rate of increase.
It's absolutely not. And it's barely even a cut in the rate of increase. Nobody in Washington wants to say no to any interest group, whether it's the farmers, the drug counselors, the old people on Medicare. Nobody wants to say we can't afford all this.
So we're toast.
Well, we're not necessarily toast. You know, our neighbors to the north, Canada, they have reduced spending as a percentage of GDP from 50% to 40% over about 10 years without really hitting a crisis. They just sort of understood things were getting out of hand and they brought it down. But we don't seem to have the same calm demeanor when we need to rein in our government.
Theirs was done by a liberal government. Maybe it was easier for them. Let's look at this pile of stuff in front of us. This is the new regulations that were just added this year. Is this a good? You have people, Obama's talking about reducing the regulatory burden. Wasn't that good news this year?
Again, we're at least talking about it, but a lot of it is just that talk. Unfortunately, we're still adding to the Federal Register. As you can see, it's growing by leaps and bounds.
Yeah, 80,000 new pages.
I do hear that at some point they're going to stop printing it and at least put it on a CD, which should save us a little bit of money. But it's a drop in the bucket, unfortunately.
And each one of those pages or each one of those booklets is a job that doesn't exist anymore or a job that wasn't created. The more you burden businesses and individuals with regulation, the fewer jobs there are going to be. It's not a difficult problem, but
each
it seems
of those,
to be too hard for politicians.
Each of those books is actually one day's worth of rulemaking from the feds, not necessarily one rule, maybe a bunch. And some people would say that creates jobs for compliance officers and lawyers at companies.
Then we should have a rule or regulation about how you brush your teeth, about how you make a Swiss cheese sandwich, about absolutely everything, because then we create billions more jobs of people monitoring all those rules. Instead of 80,000 pages, we needed 800,000 pages.
You're being
sarcastic.
That's
a grateful employment.
But intuitively, this makes sense to people.
Why be shovel ready when you could be teaspoon ready?
It seems maybe superficially to make sense, but if you push people to say, gee, is it useful to have people employed doing things that we don't really want to do other than for the fact that the government imposed some crazy regulation, most people say you're right. We don't want people employed just doing that because then everybody would be complying with regulations. Nobody would make stuff. Nobody would provide services. Nobody would engage in productive economic activity.
President Obama claimed to have gone through federal regulations with a fine-tooth comb, and he came up with a dozen regulations that he was announcing that he was ending. Teeny little regulations. That's exactly right. And meanwhile, he's giving us Obamacare, which is a massive new system of regulations on health care, pharmaceuticals, and everything. Dodd-Frank, all these other major regulations with far more costs. So it's just crazy to think that what he found were the important regulations.
I think what is interesting, though, and as much as there's a little bit of pessimism on a number of our parts, voters are going to notice that things aren't changing for them. While they're clamoring for less regulations, things seem to be about the same. While they're clamoring for less spending,
voters are clamoring for less regulation.
There certainly are. I mean, that's certainly what the Tea Party is all about. And I think that's where all of this change in Washington has come from. It's certainly not starting there. There are folks clamoring for it. They're at least asking for it. Whether or not they're getting it yet is another issue.
But for every person who's asking for less regulations, we also have somebody who's asking for their very own bailout. Occupy Wall Street movement is about. Bailouts for me, not for thee. No more bailouts for big corporations, but gee, my student loan debt is awfully large. It would be great if somebody could pick that up for me. Gee, my mortgage is too big.
Well, we're going to talk about the Occupy Wall Street people later. So thank you, panel. Stick around. We'll come back to you. Next, a libertarian analysis of the culture, including this year's movie, finally, of Atlas Shrugged. That's later, actually. Next, War and Peace, the libertarian take on how libertarian or unlibertarian has America's foreign policy been this year.
After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq will be over.
Bin Laden is dead. Bin Laden is dead. Confirmed. Urgent confirmed. Bin Laden is dead.
That was big news this year. We libertarians think government does too much, but one thing the government is supposed to do is protect us from people who want to kill us. It says, provide for the common defense here in the Constitution. But is our government doing that the right way? We go back to our all-star libertarian panel. David Bowes, Jeff Myron, Catherine Mangu Ward, and Camille Foster. So, President Obama says, you know, we're getting out.
You know, the second largest embassy the United States has is in China, which is a country of 1 billion people. By far larger than that embassy is the one we're leaving behind in Iraq. And, of course, we're not leaving it behind.
16,000 people.
16,000 people. That's not an embassy. That's a federal government. That's an indication that we're going to continue running Iraq. So we're bringing a lot of troops out, but we're still leaving the United States government in charge of Iraq. And this president, from 2002 until 2008, campaigned on, you should vote for me because I will end this war in 2009. Well, it's 2011, and we're not really ending it.
Well, he says he is. We have a clip from him.
The rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year.
The rest will come home. What do you want?
I'd like those 16,000 people to come home. Any one of those who gets killed, you know, then we're still involved in a war. And in any case, we're paying for 16,000 people and the world's largest embassy to run this relatively small nation of, I think, 25 million people.
At the peak, we had 170,000 soldiers in Iraq. Now, just 6,000. He says they're coming home.
But if we look at the number of soldiers in the Middle East, adding together Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, elsewhere, the total hasn't come down nearly as much. It has come down some. They're saying that we're going to bring all the troops home from Afghanistan by next summer, except that now the generals are pushing back and saying we haven't pacified or installed democracy in Afghanistan yet. More broadly, it's clear from all sorts of statements that come from the president and from both parties that most politicians think that we should be in the Middle East, we should be intervening, we should be looking out for our interests there. Okay? Even when it's very hard to see that we're promoting our security, we're probably making our security worse by interfering in the countries of people who would tolerate us if we left them alone, but are going to be angry at us when we come in and mess up their countries.
There are plenty of libertarians who say this is one job the government should do, and we're safer making it clear that if you're a threat to us, we're going to retaliate, and we have to keep our commitments to democracies.
And yet, every libertarian should keep in mind that virtually everything the government does, it does badly. And this is, I think, a fantastic example. If you try to rebuild a country, in fact, a couple of countries at the same time, and you put a government in charge of it, it's not going to go that well.
It's a story of unintended consequences as well. I mean, we're involved in no less than six conflicts in some way, shape, or form around the world at this point. There are unintended consequences to things like this. We have only to look at the Arab Spring. There was a lot of agitation for us to get involved in Egypt and Syria. And unfortunately, in a number of cases, those things tend to turn in a very different direction than we might like.
Some would say Libya worked well. We got rid of this horrible man, and we should have intervened in Syria.
We thought Egypt worked very well for a little while as well. So only time will tell exactly how things play out, and the very same is true about Iraq.
What about all the successes? World War II, Grenada, Kosovo, Bosnia. South Korea doesn't have to live under communism.
The libertarian position is that there are times we want to have a military, we want a strong defense, we want to promote our national security, but that some actions that the military takes, indeed many, are not promoting our security.
And look, you mentioned Libya, and I hope that that works out well. Certainly getting rid of Gaddafi's got to be a good thing. We hope that it will come out well after that. But the fact remains, the President of the United States is not authorized under the Constitution to unilaterally take the country to war, even if it seems like a good idea. And that's what he did. He didn't put troops on the ground, but he engaged in military action against a sovereign nation without any authorization from Congress. And it says in the Constitution, Congress should declare war.
And I am puzzled by some of the statements I've heard from Leon Panetta, the Secretary of Defense. We have significantly weakened al-Qaeda and its allies, decimated their leadership, and kept Americans safer. But they never then talk about, okay, we can spend less now.
Or that we can come home. We have
300,000 soldiers all around the world.
That's right.
Most of them are not in the Middle East.
But some of them are, and some of them that used to be in Iraq have been moved across the street to Kuwait. So it's not a terrible difference in terms of where our troops are. Yes, you would hope, if it's true that we got bin Laden and we got 22 of the top 30 al-Qaeda leaders, at some point don't you get to say, we have won and we get to come home.
But there's this long, terrible history of defense spending being just as sacred as entitlement spending, and in fact, of Republicans trading off protecting defense spending in order to, get a deal on entitlement spending. So the idea that defense spending might somehow, someday, somewhere decrease, I'm afraid, is a bit of a pipe dream.
Panel, stick around. Up next, the 99%. At least that's what the protesters on Wall Street call themselves. Did their antics this year mean anything? And should I be ashamed?
Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you!
If you want to get lean and ripped,
I feel unbelievable.
Sexy and toned.
This is the greatest gift you can give yourself.
Then get ready to order the number one extreme fitness program in America,
Did you know that I lie all the time? I tried to get those protesters to tell me what my lies were, but they wouldn't say anything specific. Just that I'm a corporate toad, so, or toady. So you four must be corporate toads, too, because you defend economic freedom. What do you think of the Wall Street protests? Camille, you first.
I'm probably a little more optimistic than most folks are. In the first instance, I think that what's animating the Occupy Wall Street crowd is very similar to what got the Tea Party crowd excited in the first place, and it's the bailouts, and it's the uncertainty created by an unstable economic environment where there don't seem to be easy answers. On the right, a lot of these folks have latched on to less spending and less government intrusion into the marketplace. On the left, without easy explanations, they've retreated to their standard biases.
Do you think they were really mainly upset about the bailouts? I found one woman down there who said that. Everybody else said, give me free stuff.
Well, I think it starts there. I do think that that is an animating force. I didn't have the same experience you did. No one recognized me right away. I was able
to sneak in. You don't lie all the time?
Well, I try not to anyways. But we were able to have a conversation, and we talked for several hours, and I found that at a minimum, folks were willing to acknowledge at some point that I didn't hate them and I didn't hate their grandmother and want to steal her insurance, but that we may have some differences of opinion, but where we agree, we can at least start there. Let's not bail out the banks.
Catherine?
I think a best case scenario is a miraculous fusion of the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street in which everyone gets together and realizes that big business plus big government is a disaster. I think the likely scenario is an entirely different one, unfortunately. And it's one where the Tea Partiers wind up with something like a government hands off my Medicare message, and the Occupy Wall Street people wind up with a we should probably raise taxes on the rich message. And that's not a good year for libertarians.
And I want to add that I went to the protest with a businessman friend who runs in the granola head crowd, and he pushes corporate social responsibility. And when the protesters shouted me down, he defended them.
They're trying to shut you down because they don't believe that what you're telling on the network is true. They really want to change the system. They're really interested in having a fair, equitable arrangement for the economy.
A fair and equitable arrangement. People are genuinely mad about the wealth disparity.
They have every reason to be frustrated. What drives me crazy is that they have the wrong prescription for the wealth disparity. They're right that in many cases government has promoted wealth redistributions that were terrible, such as at the bailouts. Much more broadly, there's zillions of aspects of government that reward the wrong people. The home mortgage interest deduction. It doesn't help really poor people. They don't own houses. It doesn't help most middle-income people because they don't itemize deductions. It helps people who have high incomes. So it's completely insane, and it's bad for economic efficiency, too.
But the
Occupy guys think that the problem is we don't have enough government, mm-hmm. and that to me is just completely backwards.
The optimistic view of Occupy Wall Street is that they are against crony capitalism, and that ought to be something that they could get together with the Tea Party and with libertarians.
We could call it crapitalism for sure.
We could. But my sense is they really hate business and hate the rich, and inequality is something that does bother them, not because it's a product of any particular thing the government does, but they just don't like the idea of it. You know, worldwide, there's more equality than there's ever been. Globalization is raising the incomes of the poorest all over the world. But that's not necessarily true in the United States, because some people in the United States are getting very rich. Steve Jobs got very rich. Bill Gates got very rich. The Waltons got very rich by selling stuff to relatively low-income people. In the case of the Waltons, you get a penny from every one of them, you end up very rich. I don't think that's a bad thing. I know that my life is better off because of the people who are getting rich. But obviously, the Occupy Wall Street people don't get that. They should be occupying K Street and Pennsylvania Avenue.
Let's say we have our perfect world. All right, is the best we can do to defend huge inequality to say, hey, we got good stuff from Steve Jobs and the Waltons, and that's freedom. Live with it.
happens? First of all, we know from all sorts of experience that private charity does a huge amount to help people who are unfortunate, who are unlucky, who don't have reasonable medical care, income, food, et cetera, on their own. But the redistribution that goes on in the United States and other countries is not about mainly about helping the poor. It's about helping the middle class. It's about helping the rich. So a huge fraction of all of this tinkering with the income distribution, with inequality, is no justification and it's any kind of compassion at all.
And if you value equality per se, you should love this last recession, right? The rich got hit harder. There actually is greater equality now than there has been for a while. I'm not sure that's the vision we want.
Well, for every reasonable idea at the protest, there were lots of crazy ones, like the people who object to money.
I hate money sometimes. All the time, actually. Money. If money didn't exist, things would be so much better, wouldn't you think?
We need a nanny state, basically. That we need the government to take care of us.
Why don't we have a solar paneled pipe across the United States?
So a solar paneled pipe, no money, and more nanny state. This is America.
You know, it's almost refreshing to hear all these things said just so explicitly out loud. I mean, people don't talk like that in Washington. Even when the nanny state is being expanded by leaps and bounds, it's never, government, take care of me. I'm tired of doing my own stuff. And at least the Occupy people are being honest about it.
And one bit of good news from the incoherence, it was relatively peaceful in the same area in 1920. Anarchists protesting capitalism set off a bomb in front of the J.P. Morgan building and killed 38 people. Not, we don't see that this year. So, knock on glass, good. Thank you, David Bowes, Jeff Myron, Catherine Mangu Ward, and Camille Foster. Up next, the culture wars.